everyone. Today we have Safi Mergani from Slovo. We already spoke to Safi a couple of episodes ago. For those of you who don't know, Slovo is an academic journal edited and managed by the postgraduates of UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies. And Safi is this year's editor-in-chief, but she is also doing her PhD now. And that is what are we going to talk about today. So Safi, it is really great to have you here again. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me again, Dina.
And my first question will be, what is the title of your PhD thesis?
So my current working title is I Am an Extraordinary Man, The Intimate Suffering of Russianness and Blackness. Now, I would like to note that in the first part of my title, I am an extraordinary man, the word extraordinary is placed in brackets for good reason, of course, primarily due to the fact that some of Dostoevsky's most well-known protagonists engage themselves with an attempt to be an extraordinary man, a Napoleon-like figure, but they ultimately fail. While the African-American author's characters often are engaged in a struggle just to be considered a man, right? To be afforded the same rights as other people in society. Here I'm talking about the 20th century African-American writers I look at. So that's sort of those are the reasons for my title.
And can you explain how did you come to the idea? So when did it occur to you that Dostoevsky's influence is to be seen in African-American literature of the 20th century?
Yes, of course. Well, as a teenager, I enjoyed reading African-American literature, particularly that of the 20th century. So from Zora Neale Hurston, I'm not sure if you've heard of her, at the beginning of the 20th century, to James Baldwin towards the middle, and also Toni Morrison, who sadly passed away several years ago. I was also very fascinated by Dostoevsky's novels. I remember the first work of Dostoevsky that I picked up, Crime and Punishment, I thought, okay, like this is serious. I've never read anything like this. There's something totally different going on here. And it marked sort of a huge change sort of in my, I guess, experience of reading and engaging with literature. I obviously enjoyed literature of various other national and cultural traditions, you know, like the French poet Arthur Rimbaud, the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke. But I had a special affinity for Black American literature and Dostoevsky in particular. So to actually answer your question, I just intuitively sense there to be some sort of connection there. And then when I thought about it, it wasn't difficult to identify this shared, intense preoccupation with human suffering, right, that there exists in the African-American tradition and Dostoevsky's literature, which is understandable considering the fact that you had Russian serfdom and you had the enslavement of Africans in the United States. So this is this shared historical experience of manifest oppression. But I also sense this strong, very spiritual element in both traditions that I couldn't really precisely sort of concretely put my finger on at first, but I sensed it definitely to be there, this strong spiritual element of hope. And then so after that, I use the internet as one does with many questions one has, to see whether anyone else had written about the correspondence between these two traditions. And then I came across an article by a scholar named Maria Bloshtin. And she, in this article, she treats Dostoevsky's influence on Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, and James Baldwin. And that sort of marked the commencement of my research.
Now that you like mentioned this element of hope, I don't really consider myself someone that knows a lot about the African American authors, and I've recently only started reading some books on that, and I've read Homegoing, maybe I'm going to pronounce it now, Ya Gyasi. I don't know if you've heard of that book, but it basically is this element that even though that people were suffering so much and people were going through all these horrible things, there was always like there was this thread that actually is this hope in the end, that there I mean it considers the story of generations and generations of men and women that are from Africa brought into the US, and throughout this whole process of, I mean, starts like generations and I don't know, 18th century or something like that, and then up to 20th century. And throughout this whole book, it was like this, every generation had the hope of, you know, my children, I'm doing this because my children are going to be better than I am, and I'm going to make a way for my children to live better than I did. And this element of hope is like something that I constantly had, I mean, this thought in my head. And then I realized, yeah, I mean, it's just hope, basically.
I just wanted to briefly respond. Yeah, it's really interesting what you're saying. I've not read this work myself that you've mentioned, nor do I think I've actually heard of the author, but I mean, if you could send me the details after this, I'd be very interested.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, it's an amazing book. I mean, I've read it like last month, and I read it in a heart.
You know, I mentioned Toni Morrison. I'm not sure if you've heard of her, but she's, of course, she's very prominent African-American author who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And so this is more of a disturbing anecdote, disturbing point to make, but it's sort of paradoxically substantiates this point that we're making, that there's this strong element of hope in the African-American tradition, or at least sort of all the oppressions and denigrations that these people go through as inscribed in the literary tradition, it doesn't stifle precisely this sense of hope or the sense of love, so, or a sense of human love. So Toni Morrison, in her novels, she actually depicts black slave mothers who have just given birth to their children. She depicts them actually, after giving birth to their baby, being forced to actually kill their own child because they love their child, their newborn, so much that they don't want the child to experience a life of slavery as they have. They resolve that death is preferable, is better for their children than a life of slavery. So it's like even in instances of sort of the most brutal action, there's this sense that, well, in this particular instance, they're forced into it, or more importantly, it's done out of love.
And she is one of the writers whose works you're working on in your thesis, right?
Yes, so I'm going to be dealing with Toni Morrison and other African-American female writers who were active during the 60s and 70s. I'm going to deal with them in my final chapter, because I sort of will, my dissertation will proceed in a chronological way. So Morrison and these female authors were part of the Black Arts movement of the 60s and 70s, right? And actually, this might be a good time to mention that the interesting thing about Toni Morrison is that in her efforts to depict sort of black life, But not only Black life, she talks about for her, they're only existing Black people, which is very interesting, you know. She articulates this in reference to Dostoevsky and the Russian literary tradition. Often, you can go on YouTube and find interviews in which she makes these points relating her literature to the Russian tradition. Actually, I have a number of her quotes noted down because I thought it might come in handy. So, okay, so Morrison says, the pursuit of trying to write what I call Black literature, which is not merely having Black people in it or being Black myself, has something distinctive about it, and I can't put it into critical terms. I can simply recognize it as authentic. So yeah, she's talking about this effort of writing authentic Black literature. But the interesting thing is she then says, being an African-American author, is sort of like being a Russian writer who writes about Russia in Russian for Russians. And there's also another interview in which the interviewer says to her, are you ever going to become interested in writing about white people or placing white people at the center of your literature? And this is something that sort of bristled Morrison, because she said, do people ever ask why Joyce wrote for the Irish or Dostoevsky wrote for the Russians? She sort of says, I'm paraphrasing it, but she says, no one expected Dostoevsky or the Russians to have anyone other than the Russians in mind. It's just coincidental that their literature was translated and it resonated with other people. So she has these ideas in mind when she's writing her literature, which is so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a point that is pretty logical when put like this. But that people often just forget about the fact that no one is questioning the things that the authors of, let's say, the white authors do. No one is questioning why are they writing, yeah, Dostoevsky for Russians. But then the questions like that, it's people expect from African-American writers, from Black writers, to include everyone. But at the same time, no one ever asked for the inclusion of the Blacks in other literature. Like, no one ever asked Dostoevsky, like, why don't you have... I mean, it would be... Yeah, it's the time when it wouldn't be... Yeah. Appropriate, let's say in quotes, to ask him that. But at the same time, like, I don't know, I just have that's one of the reasons why I started reading like African-American authors and African-American literature, because I wanted to see, like, it's something that I don't have anything to do with, like, any ties to it.
But that's true, and yes. No,
I'm not expected to have any knowledge of this. I'm not expected to have any ties to this, even though I live in a city where there are a lot of mixed cultures. But somehow I felt like I was sort of, like, obligated to see how African-Americans write about their experiences, their lives. And no one ever, like, expected that from me, which is sad in a way. But everyone expects from you to know Dostoevsky, and everyone expects from you to know all these other classical or non-classical works. But no one ever expects from you to know anything about the African American literature. Like, I never had it in school, or was I ever in a place where it was brought up. So that's why it was, like, also very important for me to talk to you, because this is the topic that I also want to explore more, and I also want for other people hear about it, for other people to know that it's not just the fact that we're not introduced to it, but that doesn't mean that we still can't pick up a book or, you know, Google it or listen about it. That's why I really wanted to talk to you. And this kind of people have this perception that, yeah, that's something else. That's something that I was never a part of. But at the same time, like your thesis also states, is that this human nature and human emotions and sufferings are not just a part of other people. They're also a part of everyone. And it, like the Dostoevsky's influence on the African American literature is something that I personally never would have thought of. But at the same time, when you think these are all things that are so normal and so common, that we just have to look at it from the other angle. It's actually everywhere among us.
Well, I think what you've mentioned now, this sort of essential universality of the human condition that is undeniable, no matter how many boundaries you try to put up between different groups of people, no matter how extreme you know, theories or ideas or notions of difference might be, there's this undeniable universality. And here you've gotten, you've gotten to the heart of my research. That's essentially what it's about. I mean, these African American authors that I'm looking at, they weren't just, although they were obviously intellectuals, extremely creative, I mean, powerhouses and heavyweights of world literature, even though, as you said, they might not be recognized as such in some areas. This wasn't just an intellectual game for them whereby they decided, okay, let me pick an author whom people really wouldn't expect that I would like, and let me just talk about this person a lot and really like them, da-da-da. No, it's why was it Dostoevsky? Why was it a Slavic Orthodox Christian epileptic from the 19th century who was this literary forefather for them, right? Who was this literary ancestor for so many of these African-American authors throughout the century? And it's precisely because he gets to the heart of these universal aspects, right, of the human condition. I'm talking about, I mean, all literature does, but I'm talking about, you know, suffering, but as we said, sort of the hope and the sense of redemption involved there, and if you like, sort of now or maybe later in the conversation, I can go into more detail about sure. Well, I argue that there's this essential tripartite, three-part logic that governs the Dostoevskian novel, which accounts primarily for these African-American authors' affinity or attraction or fascination for Dostoevsky's literature. Right, so three aspects of Dostoevsky's novelistic vision. The first is that suffering, one's own existential condition, right? One's own existential condition is a condition of suffering due to the very existence of other conscious life or other people. Right, so if I simplify that, you have Descartes' cogito, I think, therefore I am. But in Dostoevsky's world, it's you are, therefore I suffer. Right, so all life is suffering, and it's suffering from other people. The second part of Dostoevsky's logic is that this existential suffering, when you reduce it to its essential nature, it's always spiritual in nature, meaning that it's not just intellectual, it's a soul suffering, right? It forms the basis of one's condition. And as such, the solution to this existential suffering is also spiritual in nature, right? It is Dostoevsky's famous self-abnegating, unifying, redemptive suffering love modeled on Jesus Christ's love for humanity. And finally, the third aspect of Dostoevsky's logic that I hold attracts these African-American authors is that in Dostoevsky's novelistic world, those who experience the greatest degree of suffering also possess the greatest capacity for suffering love, or suffering love is most readily available in them. And for Dostoevsky, this is the Russian peasant population, right? It's the peasant or folk population of a country.
Now that you mentioned like the spiritual part and the actually the Dostoevsky's projection on Jesus and on religion, is that something that is also seen in African American literature? Like this, maybe this religious part, or in some way this higher power spiritual part that is maybe something that they rely on, or something that they project their suffering onto. Is this something that is also present in African American literature or not? Because I'm also interested in that part. So this is a question that just popped into my head.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting question, and I'm glad that you asked it. So in response to your question, I'd have to differentiate between the characters depicted by these authors, sort of these characters' worlds and their views, and the authors themselves, right, and their own views as it has been, you know, recorded over the years, over the decades. So in African American literature, of course, religion, Christianity plays a huge part. I mean, this was the mode by which, as you've alluded to yourself, sort of people going through intense sufferings can sort of people in societies in which humanity has thoroughly let them down. This is the mode by which they can sustain this sense of hope within them. Also, the church, the Black church, was this sort of, it was very much this social place for African Americans. They could come together, feel the sense of solidarity, feel the sense of community, you know. Interestingly, Dostoevsky, although for him, Christ and Christ's love, essentially, is the solution to humanity's sufferings, right? Despite that, I mean, it's pretty clear that Dostoevsky was probably an atheist, right? He was probably one of the greatest atheists, or most committed atheists, you could say. But that's precisely because he engaged with religion so much. He was sort of tormented by its ideas. It meant so much to him. And Dostoevsky himself writes that the atheist is only one rung below the full believer, sort of on the ladder of sort of belief or religion or these sort of things. And he actually wrote in a letter once, I believe, I might be mistaken, I believe it might have been to his doctor, but I'm not sure. He wrote, if Christ was outside of the truth, and if the truth was outside of Christ, I would still be with Christ, you know? So I've sort of digressed a little bit, but my point is that these African-American authors share the same position as Dostoevsky. So many of them held a sense of atheism. They held an atheist position. They sort of exhibit a similar progression in regards to their political beliefs that Dostoevsky did, right? So they started off adhering to socialist radical communist politics, and they moved away from that, just like Dostoevsky did. Here I'm thinking primarily of Wright, Ellison and Baldwin. And that's primarily due to what they saw as socialist politics prioritizing the collective over the individual. I can elaborate upon this much more, and I don't want to sort of ramble on, but I hope I've answered your question a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, yeah. I mean, it's something that I actually expected to be your answer, but I myself haven't gotten this feeling through. I mean, reading African-American literature, as I said, I've read a couple of books. I'm not really an expert, but it's something that I haven't come across, but something that I suspected is going to be, as you said, place of... I like how you said, like, that humanity let them down, so they turned to religion. It's something that I think is very important to put it like that. It's nicely said. You mentioned the concept of double voicedness, which is present in Russian and African American literature. Can you please explain to me what is meant by that? How is it seen in the literature you're working with?
Right. So double voicedness is a term coined by Mikhail Bakhtin, the very prominent 20th century Russian theorist, who formulated basically a poetics of Dostoevsky's literature. So Bakhtin was the first theorist to engage in a proper analysis of Dostoevsky's literature, one could say. Because the value of Dostoevsky's literature really isn't sort of its treatment of particular themes or its adherence to certain ideologies. It's the way in which Dostoevsky integrates these ideologies, these themes, into the very structural modality, into the very formal elements of his novels. So I'll explain that a little bit more. Double voicedness, okay. So according to Bakhtin, Dostoevsky's novels sort of occasioned this immense rupture in the trajectories of the European novel and also the pre-Dostoevskian Russian novel. So he argues that Dostoevsky created the polyphonic novel, which was different from the homophonic novel that had previously existed. So in the homophonic novel, the author's voice is essentially God. These characters, the characters in the novel speak, they have different voices, but their voices do not exist with equal signifying force as the author's own voice. However, Bakhtin argues that Dostoevsky created the polyphonic novel in which its totality is formed by a multiplicity or a diversity of voices which are equally valid. So basically, the voices of the characters have as much significance as the voices of the authors. In a sense, the authors don't have the final say. The characters sort of... Uh-huh. Can argue with the authors in a sense. That is basically what double voicedness is in the Dostoevskian novel. Now I'll just quickly say that this understanding of the Dostoevskian novel for Bakhtin is sort of the impetus, sort of the inspiration for his formulation of a theory of language in general, of his sociolinguistic theory in general, whereby all words, all language is double voiced. This means that if you take the basic linguistic unit of the word, one word is never, so all words are never oriented only towards the object or the subject it's focusing on. It's always oriented also to the word that someone else has said about that subject, right? So when we're speaking, we always have in mind what other people have said about that subject and what the person you're speaking to is going to say about that subject. Nothing you will ever say essentially exists independently or is created autonomously of your own mind. That's basically essentially what double voiceness is.
This reminded me, a couple of days ago, I was listening to a podcast from BBC, I don't know which one, but basically the topic was how language actually influences your reality. And there was this book that I want to read called Language Versus Reality. And it is, what is the point of it is exactly what you said, that, for example, if you were to stand in front of a painting and the title that was actually the example that was in the podcast, like if the title of the painting suggests, I don't know, blooming fields, you are going to be concentrating on the fields, on the painting, even if there is also like a small path or a house or, I don't know, the sun. These words that are written are actually influencing how you're seeing this painting and how you're gonna talk about it later with other people, and which words are you gonna use in order to explain what you saw. And it's not that you didn't see other things, it's just that language that it was used in to describe this picture, this painting, made your brain focus more on the fields and not on the other things that are on the painting as well. If I understood you correctly, this is also something that double voiceness has to do with.
Right, exactly. And so one could also extend that. So if in the future, say you're reading a book after that, the day after, and you read the word blooming, you're going to think of that painting and that title. So totally, this sense of language highlighting the interconnectedness of people's ideas and actually humanity in general.
Yeah, fascinating, really, when you think about it like that. You have another term that you mentioned in your research, and it's signifying, and the G in the end is in brackets, and I'm not 100% sure I understand what is meant by that. So can you please elaborate a little bit, and how is it reflected in the African-American literature and in the Russian literature that you're working with?
Right, okay. So I can't say that it's reflected in Russian literature, but it is in the sense that signifying is inherently double voiced. So actually, that's how it's reflected in the Russian tradition. It's just not given the descriptive appellation, signifying. So signifying, okay, so it's an African-American mode of vernacular discourse, meaning it's a non-standard English language or it's a black dialect, right? And it's a prominent 20th century African-American literary theorist called Henry Louis Gates Jr., who, he did not create signifying because that dialect already existed, but he formulated the defining theory of signifying, and it's him who puts the G at the end in brackets in order to distinguish signifying, the African American vernacular dialect, from the standard English language term of signifying. And so basically by doing that, by putting signifying in brackets, he highlights the double voiceness of signifying itself, because this Black dialect always, with it in its every word, it exists in confrontation with standard English language, essentially in confrontation with white meaning or the white semantic order. And the very invention of this Black dialect was essentially a mode by which African Americans could differentiate themselves, assert their own power, you know, status, humanity, as we mentioned, in a world in which it was denied. So in the slave narratives or in early African American literature, signifying was a mode by which speakers could make underhanded comments, say, in front of their masters or individuals subjugating them, without these individuals even knowing that they're being undermined, you know, even though this is taking place in front of them. Signifying as a Black dialect, it's basically highly metaphorical, it's highly figurative. That meaning is not conveyed in a direct way. It's conveyed through images, through rich figuration. The term signifying is also always used interchangeably with this term called playing the dozens, which is basically you could say modern rap is a sort of extended form of it. It's basically a game of insults, using highly imaginative, very vivid metaphoric language. So even though that is not signifying in its totality, that is the form in which signifying often appears. So I'm not sure if you had this where you grew up, but do you ever remember these jokes, like your mama jokes? Do you know what I'm talking about? So this is actually a form of signifying. So it's like your mama, your mother is, and then insert whatever, you know, offensive, impudent term. But then sort of this non-specified mother is described using like highly imaginative imagery, right, which sort of exhibits the speaker's own intellect, essentially. So signifying is sort of expressing African American intellect, creativity in a way utterly detached from the standard modes in which intellect and creativity is expressed in the Western world.
I've never actually heard of it. I mean, I've never heard of the term, but it is interesting to see, I mean, how it is reflected in the literature that you're working with. Like, is it something that is present, constantly present in the works that you're working with? Or not? Or is it something that just comes and goes depending on the topic of the work?
I'd say it definitely exists throughout the entire course of the 20th century African American literary tradition, and of course not just the 20th century, but the centuries before that as well. It often exists in the form of the character's direct speech, right? So these Black authors, they are not interested in pretending that the characters whom they are conceiving of, characters who subsist in a vernacular culture, they're not interested in putting standard English language in their mouths. They're not interested in pretending that they speak the Queen's English. They don't. Sort of these characters are depicted speaking in dialect, in even, you know, in some cases, broken English, and in this sense, these characters speaking in direct speech often communicate with one another using the highly vividly metaphorical language form of signifying. So it's very prominent. So Gates, the theorist who I mentioned, the theorist of African-American literature, mm-hmm. he also sort of extends his theory of signifying. So he defines signifying as intertextuality itself, right? So this is original on his part, but he talks about different authors within the African-American tradition signifying upon each other's works, right? And then he also extends this further. He says that African-American writers signify upon writers out with the African-American tradition. So I end up writing about how African-American authors signify upon Dostoevsky, which is quite interesting as well. I hope I've made that clear enough, because it's a little bit of an intricate theory, but it's definitely, of course, relevant and pertinent to what I'm doing.
And in which way do African American authors signify on Dostoevsky, like on his ideas or on the language used or on the, I'm not 100% I understand what you meant by that.
Yes. So signifying, essentially, it's another term when Gates uses the word signifying to describe African-American authors interacting with authors within their own tradition and outside their tradition. He's basically talking about intertextuality. So in that sense, he's taking the term signifying outside of its original realm of meaning, used to define. So signifying as in it defines African-American, a particular African-American vernacular discourse. Here he's taking it to mean intertextuality in general, right? So signifying is used to say, here these African-American authors have Dostoevsky in mind. They essentially have him in mind. To actually answer your question, it really depends on which authors I'm looking at. So if we take Wright, Ellison, and Baldwin, whom I've spoken about, so three male African-American authors active during the mid-20th century, they were the writers of the 20th century upon whom Dostoevsky had the greatest influence. If you take Richard Wright, his novels are often, his two novels, The Outsider and Native Son, are basically scene-by-scene revisions, sort of in the main, they are scene-by-scene revisions of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. They follow the same plot trajectory. The characters are very similar. The protagonists are very similar. The protagonists experience similar journeys. It's basically Richard Wright takes Dostoevsky's Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment and puts him in the context of a black man in mid-20th century America and sort of tells us what happens then. This influence, Dostoevsky's influence in these novels, sort of to posit his influence is not just a conjecture or a supposition. I mean, it's so manifest, the Dostoevskian influence in there. And scholars have written about this, and it's so clearly manifest. And even outside of the literature, Richard Wright explicitly spoke about Dostoevsky's influence on him. I mean, records of the novels in his personal libraries, Richard Wright's letters to his friends and acquaintances, sort of he's He's always talking, thinking about Dostoevsky. He even mentioned that Dostoevsky, at one point he said Dostoevsky is the greatest writer of all time, you know. So it should not be underestimated, his influence. And his influence on Ralph Ellison and James Baldwin as well. So Ralph Ellison, I don't know if you know his most well-known work, the only novel of his published during his lifetime, Invisible Man.
I think I've heard of it, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, so it was published during the 1950s. There's actually this really interesting anecdote I read about online very recently. This apparently Obama, in his younger years, he carried around Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man with him. He was so tied to it, because it's so interesting. Even for me, the first time I started reading it, it was too much. It was too difficult. Not in the sense of the language or anything. Although it's of course it's a masterpiece. But in the sense that he really deals head on with, you know, discrimination, racism, human suffering, these things sort of unblinkingly. And basically, this text as well is highly influenced by Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. Very much so, you know, especially in its opening. And Ralph Ellison also, it's been recorded, it's attested to that he openly spoke about Dostoevsky. He was openly, he was very much influenced by Dostoevsky.
Now you've mentioned a couple of authors, and in your thesis, you look at the works of authors from the 20s, 30s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and how does the influence of the Russian literature on African-American authors change throughout time? Does it change, actually? As far as I understood from what you've sent me, some of them didn't experience any of the Dostoevsky's influence, and some of them did.
Right. Yes. You're exactly right. So if you look at the African-American writers of the Harlem Renaissance movement, which was active during the 20s and 30s, there was certainly the influence of the Russian tradition in general certainly existed, in the sense that these Black authors who were concerned with inscribing an authentic Black voice into literature, they looked to Russian authors of the 19th century who had been engaged in valorizing their own folk peasant culture. So these African American authors look to them as inspiration for doing the same thing within their own tradition. So ultimately what happens is these Harlem Renaissance authors, they place great emphasis upon Black dialect, Black vernacular in their literature, mm-hmm. As opposed to just trying to emulate standard English language. As I mentioned, Wright, Ellison, and Baldwin, Dostoevsky had a huge influence on them. I also mentioned that Toni Morrison, one of the female authors active during the Black Arts Movement of the 60s and 70s, sort of frequently made reference to Dostoevsky and the Russians when articulating her own efforts to write, what she describes as peasant or village literature for Black people. So it's really interesting she uses the words peasant and village literature. Now, for the male authors of the Black Arts Movement of the 60s and 70s, their relationship with Dostoevsky was very different. Mm-hmm. So this will obviously make for a very interesting chapter in my dissertation. So these authors, or the most prominent authors, Black authors of the Black Arts Movement, they expressly rejected any Dostoevskian influence on their work. And they did so repeatedly and emphatically. So you have a writer named Ishmael Reed, And then I also made sure to bring up some of his quotations. Let me take a look. So he makes various comments whereby he sort of pinpoints the nature of Dostoevsky's appeal for certain authors, but at the same time he distances himself from having any Dostoevskian influence. He writes, well, he says actually in an interview, "What makes Dostoevsky great? I don't think he's all that great. It's not because he knows how to put a sentence together, or he knows how to make things logically follow, or paragraphs follow. It's because of something in his heart, some kind of drive, some kind of demonic genius." Right, so obviously the word demonic there is very interesting. I mean, I assume he's probably there referring to the Dostoevsky's sort of unblinking confrontation treatment of human suffering in his works, and also the fact that Dostoevsky depicts, well, if you actually look at Dostoevsky's motley of characters, he depicts murderers, thieves, terrorists, child molesters, you know. So it's very interesting, but he treats them, he does not fully demonize them at all. He always gives them the opportunity for spiritual salvation. But anyway, to get back to the point, you have another writer, Ernest Gaines of the Black Arts Movement, who also disavowed a Dostoevskian influence. He once said, "People think that I should like Dostoevsky, and I've never liked Dostoevsky." Okay, so there's obviously no equivocation there. But he rejects Dostoevsky in favor of another 19th century Russian author, Ivan Turgenev. He says, "Turgenev's Fathers and Sons showed me more than any book of Dostoevsky." And then in regard to Turgenev's novels, he says, "Maybe I've always been much more attracted by the not pastoral, but some of it." So here he's saying, obviously, Turgenev depicts peasant population in, one could say, their natural habitat, but Dostoevsky doesn't. Dostoevsky is not concerned with depicting scenes of nature and engaging in detailed descriptions of scenery, as Bakhtin essentially demonstrates. Dostoevsky is just interested with the individual mind. Right, and he deals with relationships between people as they are manifest, as they are made manifest, in terms of the struggle in one person with the ideas of others. So it's all about how people deal with each other, but how it leads to struggle all the time. But ultimately, Dostoevsky argues that interpersonal relationships through suffering, love is the only solution to human existential suffering. And I'll quickly mention one final African-American author of the Black Arts Movement, Albert Murray. He also writes that he's not interested in, quote, "writing a conventional Dostoevsky-type novel, laying on the details and explaining rather than evoking with images, movement, and pulse." And he also said that he preferred writing chapters, quote, "like musical figures," unquote, and quote, "paragraph that is a poem," unquote. So that's also interesting, and one could disagree with him that Dostoevsky is just describing things and he's not evoking images. And it's interesting that he also says that he prefers writing chapters like musical figures, because Bakhtin's analysis of Dostoevsky is rooted precisely in musical analogy, because describing Dostoevsky's novel as the polyphonic novel, of course, precisely employs musical analogy. So it's interesting there.
Yeah, this is, I think this
is... Sorry, that was a lot of information. No, I just threw on, just rambling on.
I'm trying to process everything, but if you look at it like that, it's actually I mean, for me, when reading Dostoevsky, I always have this feeling that I am inside of a person, inside of the mind, and I always have this picture. So by saying that Dostoevsky doesn't paint pictures, I really don't feel like that. But I mean, anyways, one can argue on that. Everyone has their own way of processing, well, everything. Safi, thank you very, very much for sharing everything today with me and with my listeners. It was really such a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me, Dina. I've really enjoyed the chat, very much so.
I'm really interested in seeing how your final work is going to look like. I would definitely like check on you in a year or something to see how far did you come with writing and with wrapping up your thesis. But in the meantime, yeah, thank you very much. We've talked for an hour. We can make a wrap here.
Well, it flew by, and thank you.